You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael. Are Kurdish people building a socialist feminist utopia in northern Syria under the noses of the Islamic State, the watchful eye of the Assad government, and now falling bombs of the Turkish military? That's what recent articles in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and even Vogue magazine contend. The region, known as Rojava, has not only a women's army, but women's courts and women's councils with ultimate decision-making power on issues concerning women. Despite a flurry of interest in the region and especially its women fighters and the recent Turkish bombing of one of its cantons, Afrin, most people to whom I mention it look blank or think I'm talking about the Rohingya in Burma. My guest, Janet Beal, has spent some time in Rojava, and she's the translator of the 2016 book, Revolution in Rojava, Democratic Autonomy and Women's Liberation in Syrian Kurdistan, published in English by Pluto Press. Janet, let's start with what and where Rojava is.
All right. Rojava is located, well, first of all, just let me say, it's no longer called, specifically called Rojava, because that's a name that in Kurdish means the West, as in Western Kurdistan. You understand that the Kurds live in four countries in the Middle East. So North Kurdistan would be the part in southeastern Turkey. East Kurdistan would be Rojava, the part in Iran. South Kurdistan is basically like where the Kurdish regional government is in Iraq. And West Kurdistan was northern Syria, where a lot of Kurds lived. They originally called it Rojava because the Kurds were instituting a new political system there. But they're very, very intent on being ethnically and religiously inclusive. And you can't call it by a Kurdish name if you're going to do that. So in 2016, the name was officially changed to the Democratic Federal System of Northern Syria, which is kind of anonymous, but it's, you know, doesn't have any ethnic overtones. And so that's, I can call it the DFNS, or just for shorthand, I can refer to it as Rojava in this interview, but I hope you don't take that as inferring that I'm a Kurdish chauvinist or something like that, that I'm really, it's just that that's what I'm accustomed to calling it, and it's easier in a conversation. But I'm referring, when I say Rojava, I mean the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, okay?
Okay, great.
So it's located along the northern border of Syria, just south of Turkey, just across from that artificial line that was drawn in the 1920s after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, you know, and the victors in World War I carved up the Middle East into separate states. And originally at one point, it seemed like the Kurds might get their own state under an agreement called Sevres. But once the Turkish Republic was created, they threw their weight around and prevented that from happening. And so the Kurds ended up being minorities in a lot of different states rather than getting their own state. And so along the southern border of Turkey in northern Syria, that's where a lot of Kurds lived. The quantity of Kurds increased there over the years because the Kurds in Turkey were experiencing such persecution that they tended to flee into northern Syria. And then at one point, starting in 1965, Syrian Arab Republic, the Baath leader, started promoting an Arabization program. In other words, they deliberately tried to move Kurds out of the north and move Arabs in. So they uprooted Arabs from villages in Raqqa and other places in the south and Deir ez-Zor and moved them into the north to try to supplant the Kurdish population there, to thin it out so it wouldn't be so heavily Kurdish. And so today there's a lot of Arabs living there. And there's also like plenty of other peoples. There's Turkmens, Assyrians, Assyriacs, Armenians, Chechens, and a diversity of religions, including obviously Islam, but also Yazidi, Alawites. There's even some Jews there, and Alevi Kurds. So it's a very ethnically heterogeneous area. And the new system that they're trying to put in, that they have put in place, is above all intent on on being ethnically inclusive. In fact, when I was there in late 2014 and also in 2015, we visited a number of academies and training centers for internal police, for military, for women, and almost every place my delegation went, we were told that they received a very clear message: no payback, no revenge taking, no retaliation. In other words, the Kurds had been so persecuted, so heavily persecuted by under the Assad regime, really since the since the creation of the Syrian Arab Republic, that it would, you know, there's some people would say that human nature would sort of require them to get payback right now. Oh, we're in charge. We'll just reverse the situation.
But sorry, are there sirens outside your window?
Yes, there's a siren. I'm sorry. You want me to repeat what I just said?
Just what you just said, yeah.
Yeah. So it would have been, some people would regard it as understandable and consistent with human nature if the Kurds had simply said, all right, we're in charge now, it's payback time, and persecuted the Arab population as they had been persecuted under the Syrian Arab regime, which denied their ethnicity. But in fact, it's very important to this new system that to model ethnic and religious tolerance and inclusivity. They see themselves as a possible model for the future of all of Syria. And they want to show that different people of different ethnicities and religions can all live together in harmony. And in order for that to be valid, you have to renounce revenge taking. And I think that's one of the most brilliant things of all in the system. The social contract, which they adopted in January of 1914, starts out by naming all of the different ethnicities in the area and saying, you know, it doesn't call it a Kurdish polity. It calls it lists the different ethnicities, and there are three official languages, Kurdish, Arabic, and Aramaic. So they're working very hard to be what we would call pluralistic in the West, I think, in those areas. So you asked me. So it was in January in 2014, there were three cantons created following what they called democratic autonomy. To the east, the easternmost one, the largest one, is Cizre, which is where I visited. The middle one was called Kobani, and the westernmost one was Afrin. And originally, none of them were geographically connected. But they had a but since the in the war against ISIS, the military forces, which I can talk about later, have established a land corridor between the two, to the easternmost one and the central one, between Cizre and Kobani, so those are now connected, and it's just Afrin alone out there to the west that doesn't have a land bridge. So and the population is several million. It's unclear. I've had trouble getting a fix on actual population numbers, somewhere between, I would guess, between like 3 and 6 million, but it keeps changing because a lot of refugees come from other parts of Syria to stay there because they know it's peaceful and stable in Rojava, and that they will be taken care of. They will get food, for example. That part of northern Syria was the breadbasket of Syria under the Assad regime. So they have food. Everybody gets bread every day. So refugees know that they'll be fed and that they'll be safe. So more keep coming, and it makes it difficult to calculate population numbers.
And geographically, I read that it's about the size of Connecticut.
Yeah, that sounds about right, but I don't know exactly. I'm not so good at geographical areas.
So how did you get involved in this issue and in going to this area?
I got involved because of my partnership with the late Murray Bookchin, who was an anarchist and who was an author of numerous books. He called himself a libertarian socialist as well, or a communalist. He argued that he tried to turn face-to-face democracy into a coherent program for the left in the wake of the failure of Marxism-Leninism. So, which he had been a Marxist as a child and turned against it pretty early. But he developed a system called libertarian municipalism, in which basically citizens would meet in assemblies, and these would be become units of self-government, and then drawing on the history of the CNT, the Confederación Nacional del Trabajo, the Spanish Anarcho-Syndicalist Union, which was organized in a multi-tiered confederation. He adopted that model to cover for self-government over broader geographic areas than just like one town or one ward of a city. A citizens' assembly would be the self-governing unit of a neighborhood or an urban neighborhood or a village or a town. But these assemblies would confederate in multiple tiers to self-administer over larger areas. He tried to get, and it would constitute, he thought, a dual power to the nation state. And as more people participate in it would get more power, and we could have a society where people govern themselves. It was, Murray intended it as a practical program for creating a free, democratic, ecological, rational, non-hierarchical society. But it didn't gain traction. His ideas didn't gain traction so much in the U.S. I was his collaborator and his romantic partner. We lived together. We were living together in 2004, but a message came from a German Kurdish activist saying that he was in touch with Öcalan's lawyers and that Öcalan had been reading Murray's books in Turkish translation and reading about these self-governing committees and communes and citizens' assemblies and thought that they were a very good idea. For the Kurdish, that they would be very suited to the Kurdish movement, that in fact Öcalan had been in his island prison in solitary confinement, poring over these books, and that he considered himself a good student. I can put quotation marks around good student of yours, Murray, and he considered himself a social ecologist. That's the name of the ideas that Murray used, the label that Murray used for his own ideas. And at that time, Murray was he was a couple of years away from death. He was very sick and disappointed and wasn't able to have the dialogue that Öcalan and the people around him seemed to have wanted. And so, but he did end up commending Öcalan and picking what seemed like a very good system for the Kurds. When Murray died in 2006, the PKK Assembly wrote a very moving tribute to what they called the great social scientist of the 20th century, who showed us the importance of a democratic and non-hierarchical and ecological society. And they said that they resolved to create the first Bookchinite polity on planet Earth. And they saluted him. And it was just very, very, very touching. I was busy writing Bookchin's biography, which was later published as Ecology or Catastrophe by Oxford University Press. But once I had some time, I started paying attention to what was going on over there in Kurdistan, and I was invited to visit Diyarbakir, the largest city in Turkish Kurdistan. In 2011, I attended something called the Mesopotamian Social Forum, and then after that, I visited Rojava twice, and I've translated two books so far from German into English on Kurdish matters. Why German? Because a lot of Kurds live in Germany. There's a Kurdish diaspora from Turkey, right? Because things are so hard for Kurds there. There's a large diaspora, especially in Germany and in the UK. And so since there are so many Kurds in Germany, there are a lot of Germans. Germans are interested in their movement and aware of their movement, and they've done a lot of their own work in studying it and writing it up in German. So the Germans are actually very much farther ahead of English language activists in this respect. And since I know German from earlier times in my life, I was in a position to translate some of the groundbreaking works that were being published there by their amazing activists, amazing and longtime activists like Anja Flach and Ercan Eboya and Michael Knapp.
So talk about what you observed during your visits to Rojava and some of the women especially that you met there.
All right. Well, in terms of the women, I was honored to meet members of what was then called Yekiti Star Women's Union, or Star Union, which is now, the name has been changed to Congrea Star, K-O-N-G-R-E-Y-A, Star, and the name Star refers to Ishtar, an old goddess, from ancient goddess from that area. Congrea Star, as it was formed in around 2005, in other words, under the Assad regime, they began to do a lot of the early organizing. The men, because I guess the regime didn't suspect women of acting politically as much as the men, so women could get away with more. In this Middle Eastern society, women were not political actors. They were expected to stay home and work and raise children, not go out to work at all. This is, by the way, a very painful and difficult area of the world for women, with forced marriages, early marriages, polygamy, and above all, honor killings. I don't know if your listeners will know what an honor killing is, but just to be briefly about it, suppose a young woman falls in love with a man who is not the man that her family has arranged for her to marry. She must die. And so her male family members literally take her out into the woods and, you know, shoot her or strangle her. And they have complete impunity to do that. In fact, it's expected that they will do that.
Let me interject that Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian, who's a Palestinian feminist scholar and activist, rejects the term honor killing. She says there's no honor in it. She likes to use femicide and mm-hmm. has written extensively promoting that lens. I use familial killings because not all of the people who suffer these crimes are women. Go ahead.
Okay. I accept all of those improvements. Just for the purposes of communicating to your listeners, that's the term that's most commonly used. But I think yes, all of those would be better. In any case, what they really do is, maintain patriarchy and serve men's egos. In the social contract that I mentioned before, the one that starts out naming all of the different ethnicities and religions that live in Rojava, polygamy and these kinds of killings and early childhood marriage are all banned.
So can I ask, what happens if someone engages in one of those behaviors? I mean, especially maybe not honor killing, although, or familial killing, but say polygamy or early childhood marriage.
Okay, well, if a man who is married takes a second wife, he's no longer allowed to participate in the political institutions of the society. It's banned. And any of these what are now crimes that all the things you listed are now considered crimes, and they fall under the jurisdiction of the women's courts and the women's councils. In other words, all these patriarchal abuses of women are now in the hands of women themselves for achieving justice. In the past, it would have always been the man's word, which would have much more weight vis-a-vis the woman's word. Now they're considered equal. And the court system is structured in a very popular democratic way. They have a community system of jurisprudence by which they're called peace and consensus committees, and which a large number of community members, in some cases several hundred, will function as the jury or the investigating body, and they'll look into the complaints and investigate both sides rather than just listening to the man's side. And they'll try to get to the bottom of what happened equitably. I know it may seem very normal in some cases in the Western system, but to look at to weigh the words of a man and woman equally, that's a radical concept. So the women can achieve justice in ways they never could before. So I was saying that I met with members of Yekichia Star, now called Congrea Star, when I visited Rojava, because you asked me that question. I visited women's academies. I visited an academy and a platoon of the YPJ. These are, that's the acronym for the Women's Protection Units. They were formed as a spinoff from the YPG, the People's Protection Units, which was originally a mixed militia. The YPG was formed in 2013, and if you've been following events in this battle against ISIS at all, you've seen pictures of these women in fatigues carrying AK-47s and battling IS, and in fact, they're an extremely effective fighting force. There's about, I think the ratio is about maybe it's between 30% and 40% of the Kurdish fighting units, and rather mixed ethnicity fighting units of the DFNS are YPJ.
Can I ask a couple of questions? One, so are all of the women, and I think that these images of the women fighting are probably the most familiar to listeners mm-hmm. and to me, like that's been most of the focus in the U.S. press has been mm-hmm. on the militias. Is the YPJ, are all the women fighting in the YPJ now, or are there still women in the YPG and also these separate units of women?
They're also still mixed units, yes. And I don't also mean to, while you're talking, while you're reviewing what I've been saying, I realize there's a lot that I've missed. The organizing technique of the STAR movements was to go around and knock on the doors of all the houses in a city like, say, Kamishlo, all the houses in a neighborhood, not just the ones who support the revolution, not just the houses where people live who support the revolution, but of very, very religious Islamic women, of people who belong to political parties that don't care for the revolution. The women are trying to transcend these divisions. They knock on the doors to make sure that the woman in every household knows that there's a Malad Jinn, a women's house, available to them if they ever need it. It's like a combination of a battered women's shelter, a court, a clinic, an educational place. There's numerous malajins and numerous kinds of institutions for women that are being set up in the cities, so that women know that if they have problems at home, they can go there, they can get an education, they can learn livelihood, so they don't have to be dependent on economically on the male members of their family, but they can be self-determining for the first time. So there's a whole social underpinning to eliminating these most obvious abuses of patriarchy. I mean, if a woman is financially independent, you're not going to be able to just take her out into the woods and strangle her, you know? I mean, a family might even be dependent on her income, right? So I think they see this making women into social and political and economic actors as necessary groundwork for not just the liberation of women, for the liberation of women, including the jettisoning of these barbaric practices back into the waste bin of history where they belong.
So decisions regarding things like schools and bridges and infrastructure and distribution of resources are made, in my understanding, by councils. And these are councils, I think I read, of about 300. Okay. So how are these councils chosen?
Okay, so the unit with the 300 households is actually not a council. It's a commune. That's the citizens' assembly. That's that like what Bookchin talked about. Its territory is something we don't have here so much in the U.S., but they have it there. It's called the residential street. It's like just a street with houses along it. All people in those households can come. There's no way of choosing them. This is mm-hmm. the commune. This is the face-to-face democratic unit at the very foundation of the society, and they make decisions about all kinds of things related to that community and even beyond. So that unit at the level of the neighborhood street is the commune. They choose, or they meet, I think, once a week or something like that. They choose delegates to a council that will consist of delegates from other communes in that area called the neighborhood, in an area it's a little confusing because we might think of, you know, a street as a neighborhood, but the neighborhood is a larger unit than the residential street. The neighborhood consists of several of them, and they have a mandated delegates from each commune are sent to the neighborhood council. That's the first tier of the confederation. Then the neighborhood councils, they choose delegates that are sent to the district level, and the district consists of a city and its surrounding rural areas, its surrounding villages. So notice that there's also, in the villages, they have also formed communes and village communities, right? So the district encompasses rural and urban. And then the cantonal level is the third level above where mandated delegates are sent to. And there's also now the regional level, but I'm not as so much so clear on how that functions, so I'm not quite sure how to talk about that. I don't want to make it seem like this is the only this bottom up system of self government through assemblies and confederation, that this is the only polity in Rojava. It was the one that conforms to the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan called democratic confederalism. At the time of the declaration of autonomy, democratic autonomy by those three cantons in January of 2014, they also adopted institutions called another layer called the democratic autonomous administrations. They were at war with Turkey and with radical jihadists, and were trying to get recognition from Western countries, and they were afraid that the bottom-up democracy was too radical, and that was the reason why Western democracies weren't paying any attention to them. So they thought that, well, we'll set up a more normal, a more conventional kind of administration with a legislative council and an executive council at the cantonal level, in hopes of gaining endorsements from Western countries. But these were not forthcoming, for reasons we can go into later. But in any case, there is this kind of at least when I was there, and as much as I've continued to follow it since my visits, there's this kind of two-tiered system that of the assemblies in confederation at the grassroots level, and then a kind of a conventional parliamentary legislative council and executive council coexisting, and they interact with each other, they interplay with each other. I think the sovereignty is divided between them somehow, but I don't know Arabic, and I haven't spent enough time there to study it personally myself. I can't speak to exactly how they interact.
So one of the things that I found extremely confusing is trying to sort out what the relationship is between this Rojava autonomous area and Syria and Turkey. You mentioned the PKK, that is what we know as the Kurdistan Workers Party.
Yes.
And that, my understanding is, comes out of Turkey, and that,
yes,
Öcalan was from Turkey. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, he was half Kurdish and half Turkish himself. I think his mother was Turkish.
So the Turkish government claims that the intent of that the YPG and YPJ are part of or allied with the PKK, and which it claims considers a terrorist organization trying to break away from Turkey, break away the Kurdish area from Turkey. And they contend that the intent of Rojava is to export their revolution to the Kurdish areas in Turkey and eventually unify those areas. I mean, it sounds like there might be truth in that, because they sort of are ideologically informed by one another and have some ethnicities in common. So, you know, to what extent is that legitimate?
So, remember I told you that Öcalan was reading Bookchin and shifted over to this ideology of a bottom-up democracy while he was in prison? And maybe I didn't make that clear, but the word went out.
No, I think you did.
And between, for about 5 years, from maybe 2000 to 2005, the PKK underwent a whole discussion about changing their ideology. They had originally been founded as a Marxist-Leninist liberation movement, and their goal was a separate Kurdish state, full stop. But during the course of this ideological change, this paradigm shift that the PKK underwent, they gave up the demand for an independent state, and they gave up Marxism-Leninism, and instead they adopted democratic confederalism with its, because they realized they're never going to get a Kurdish state. It's not going to happen, or at least not in the foreseeable future. So instead, let's go for this bottom-up democracy based on these citizens' assemblies, and not attempt to break away from those four states where Kurds live, but to be able to form their own semi-autonomous units within those states. It's something, you know, Turkey is very, very intolerant of Kurds. According to the Turkish constitution, the citizens of the Turkish Republic are Turks, period. It doesn't recognize ethnicities. And the Kurds basically, you know, starting in the 1920s and for decades after, they were just asking for recognition of their identity, the ability to speak their language at home, recognition of Kurdish culture, of Kurdish language, and you would think, I mean, that if Ankara had been clever, they would have done what Ottawa did in Canada and just allow some cultural autonomy. That's really what all the Kurds were initially asking for. But no, the Turkish state did not permit that. It wanted homogeneity, so the Kurds had to assimilate. And the Kurds couldn't get any recourse over the years. And so in 1978, they founded the PKK because there was just no other option but to go to war. And so that's what they did. And they that war continues to this day. They're still at war with the Turkish state. Although they don't attack civilians. Of course, Ankara called some terrorists that they call. But I have to tell you that Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, will call anybody who disagrees with him a terrorist at this point. I mean, it's a word that's thrown around so fast and loose. All the PKK is trying to do is to get basic human rights for Kurds. And the more Turkey turns into a dictatorship, which is what it is now, the more they call for the democratization of Turkey. They want Turkey to be democratized, and they would like to have some basic, modest self-government in the southeast, you know, so that the Kurdish people can manage their own affairs there. But they're not trying to break away from Turkey. Similarly, Rojava, or the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, is not trying to break away from Syria. On the contrary, they respect existing international borders, and they would like all of Syria to follow this model. And so wherever they go, when they liberate an Arab village, they give them the option of accepting this new political system of bottom-up democracy and gender equality, and in many cases it's been accepted. So, but they would like to see that they see themselves as a model for the Middle East, for a democratic and inclusive Middle East. And so so they're not trying to break away, and they're not trying to export autonomy or separatism to the PKK. That would be futile, since the PKK had that whole discussion and gave it up a long time ago. What the Kurds in southeastern Turkey would like is a system like what Rojava has now, with a basic minimal self-government and Kurdish rights and, frankly, a democratized Turkey. And in some ways, you can see why that's what this fascistic leader, Erdogan, is terrified of calls for democracy. And one of the former co-chair of the PYD, Salih Muslim, uses the word Kurdophobic for Erdogan. And I think that's very apropos. It's not simply a matter of denying Kurds their rights and assimilating them, but Erdogan has mounted campaigns of destroying Kurdish cities, of reducing them to rubble in the southeast. This was in 2016. The Kurdish armed forces were going into, Turkish armed forces were going into Kurdish cities and reducing them to rubble, and even burning people alive in basements to try to instill fear in them and get them to give up their ideas. And Turkey was supporting the Salafi jihadist groups, was supporting al-Qaeda related groups, was supporting the different groups that are under that now go under the rubric of the FSA, that are,
Free
radical
Syrian
Islamists.
Army.
Turkey was actually supporting them in their battles, in their fights against the Kurds. Right, that was the alignment, that Turkey was aligned with these radical jihadists. So Turkey is. I think Kurdophobic is a good word, and to see this successful, democratic, prosperous society growing up just across the border to the south is intolerable to Erdogan. That's why he's invading Afrin now. It's not the first time, by the way. They've been Turkish forces have been shelling Afrin since at least October of 2015. Just the bombarding Afrin from just across the border, and now they've since January they've been invading and bombing cities, bombing rural areas, bombing civilian areas in an attempt to. They say that they're going to overrun Afrin, and they're going to return it to its essentially ethnically cleanse it, to remove the Kurdish population, and repopulate it with Arabs only. That's who they see, who Turkey sees as the rightful owners of that area. So, does that answer your question?
Yes.
You asked a lot. And yeah. I'm not sure I covered everything. But.
And now I have another one.
Okay.
Of course. And I'm also conscious that, I have a lot more I'd like to ask about it, and I'm not going to have time for all of it. So I'm trying to prioritize. But, I can't imagine that the Syrian government, the Assad regime is also not a big fan of bottom-up democracy. And so I can't imagine that if the Assad government wasn't fighting on so many fronts, that his regime also would not be trying to crush this alternative community. I read an interview in which you referred to the way in which war brings people together and can sometimes foster democracy, as well as we know, it can also foster authoritarianism. But, democracy, because the participation of all of the people is needed during wartime, and so people's concerns have to be addressed in order for them to participate. And you referred to that in terms of childcare, that women can't participate if there's not some provision made for how their kids are going to be cared for. So I'm wondering, it can't be a coincidence that the Rojava experiment in radical democracy really began in 2011 under the rubric of the Arab Spring, like when the insurrection in Syria began. I'm wondering if you think it can survive, assuming that at some point the region manages to make peace or something like peace. Do you think that this formation will be able to survive?
Well, just to correct, the Rojava Revolution was July 2012, but by that time these democratic institutions had already been in place. They had been building them since like 2005 and 2006. Especially those women of the STAR movement that I've been telling you about. They had been so that when Assad withdrew his forces from the north in July of 2012, that they were on the ground as the self-government of the society, and they've gone on to flourish since then. The Assad forces have really been preoccupied for the most part with fighting the FSA, with fighting the jihadists. In other parts of the country, they sort of kept their hands off Rojava for a while. It would have been to fight Rojava would have meant opening a second front, and they weren't able to do that. So they've been concentrating on fighting in other parts of Syria. There's Assad regime. There have been technical and practical arrangements with the Assad regime. For example, there are neighborhoods of Qamishlo, the largest city in Cizre, that are still controlled by the Assad regime. The airport in Qamishlo is still controlled by the Assad regime. Some of the employees of the oil industry, and there's oil in this area, in Cizre, are paid by the Assad regime. So there have been sort of some tactical accommodations made. And now there are, but on the other hand, Assad doesn't want Turkey to overrun the north, right? And so there's been a talk about Assad, the regime sending regime military forces to assist what's called the SDF, which is the sort of umbrella name for the YPG and YPJ and Arab battalions, to assist them in fighting and defending Afrin against the Turkish invasion. In the future there may be some kind of conflict with the Assad regime, but I think for the system that Rojava, that the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria represents, it's a matter of winning over the willingness of the people and expanding the territory that wants to participate in this self-government. And thanks to the lack of revenge taking, and especially the amazing organizing efforts of the women of Rojava, they've been able to ensure that their system is stable and that it is friendly. There's a lot of suspicions to overcome, but I think that their strategy, and I haven't talked to anyone about this, but I think that their strategy must be to try to create to spread democracy with a lot of popular support while they still can, while IS is still a threat, while the regime forces are still busy fighting Salafi, the FSA. There could very well be a confrontation that destroys the whole system. But I think they also are planting deep roots, and I think that it's very important they really need people in other parts of the world, like residents of the Bay Area of California, to know about what's going on and to spread the word and to pressure our government, such as it is right now, to condemn the invasion of Afrin and to do what's necessary to make sure that this remarkable experiment in values that the West professes to hold, to ensure that this experiment continues and grows.
Well, I did want to ask about that piece about, what we should be demanding from our government, because I think that one of the reasons that this movement has not gotten the enthusiastic support of the left in this country has some to do with, my understanding is that the YPG and YPJ have gotten some financial and maybe even military support from the Pentagon and the CIA. And so that obviously makes a lot of us, who are generally anti-imperialist, nervous about supporting them. First of all, is that not true? Because I'm pretty sure about that. And, has there been any discussion on the ground there about what that might mean?
So you mentioned financial assistance. That is totally news to me. I've never heard a word about financial assistance from the U.S. What they have done is to contribute some special forces and light arms to the SDF. Nothing too heavy. It started with at Kobani. IS had overrun Kobani, right? If you remember, in late 2004 and 2015, and the YPG and YPJ back then were trying to overthrow that occupation. And finally, shamed by inaction, the Obama administration started using airstrikes, so the YPG-YPJ could radio in coordinates of spots, of ISIS spots, and the U.S. led coalition would bomb them. And so that has continued ever since then. That was necessary for their survival. It was because of that U.S. aid plus the incredible fighting ability of the YPG and YPJ that the IS occupation of Kobani was rolled back, and it's now a free place. I'm not at all sure that it would have been successful without U.S. assistance, and I don't see any. I understand that there's this anti-imperialist rejection of U.S. aid and perhaps anybody that the U.S. helps, but I haven't seen any indication that this partial military assistance that the U.S. has been providing has had any effect whatsoever on the system. I have not heard of a single indication that the U.S. is demanding, that
control of the oil
or anything like that. I haven't heard anything like that. So if people know something about that I've missed, then please let me know. But in the meantime, I think it's tactical, like with the Assad regime. There are some tactical compromises that are being made, and if you want to be very pure and say the system should not accept any aid from the U.S., then I'm afraid the experiment would have been ended long ago. I don't think they could have held out. They certainly could not have defeated IS at Raqqa. They certainly couldn't. I don't think they could have defended their system sufficiently, given the arms that the unending stream of arms that Turkey was willing to send to IS. So.
Just with our last few minutes here, tell us what you're working on now.
At the moment, I told you I translate from German into English books related to the Kurdish movement. Right now, I'm translating the 3-volume memoir of Sakine Cansız, who was one of the co-founders of the PKK back in 1978. She was one of two women at the founding Congress, and she was I like to call it the godmother of the Kurdish women's movement today. She represented for them in ways that in prison during the 1980s, and then once she was released as a fighter and ambassador and recruiter in the 90s and 2000s. She was assassinated by Turkish intelligence in Paris in January of 2003. But at some point in the 1990s, she had sat down with a manual typewriter in the mountains of northern Iraq and typed out 3 volumes of her life story in 3 volumes in Turkish. And it was published in Turkish. And when I went to a conference in Hamburg in 2014, I saw that it had been translated into German. So I asked the woman behind the table, "Where's the English?" And she said, "It's not there, doesn't exist." And so that's when I realized that this woman is just too important, and her story needs to be told, because it's also the story of the PKK and why it was formed and what it was trying to do back in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And it will be the book, volume one of this 3-volume memoir, will be published by Pluto Press in April, so just a couple of months from now.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. And so please, let me know when that's available, and hopefully we can do another interview about that.
Okay.
I would love to hear more about her and her life. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Kate. Thanks very much for it was great talking to you.